Remember, a proverb is a pithy, pointed, provocative statement that's aimed at communicating a very profound truth. A proverb, in essence, is designed to hit you right between the eyes. It's a spiritual wake-up call to get you back on track with God. An unexpected slap in the face. You're reading the Proverbs and all of a sudden one jumps out at you and you say, "Wow, that applies to me. I need to see that. I need to apply that." The Proverbs are indeed powerful. We'll start tonight in chapter 21. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Like the rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wishes. It's interesting how mighty men sit on thrones. They think they're ruling the world, but in reality, they're nothing but puppets on a string. God is the one who's in control. And God is manipulating the governments of man according to His sovereign purposes. The decisions that are shaping the political configurations of our world are not made in Moscow or in Washington, but are made in heaven. Never forget that history is His story. Think of the mighty Caesar Augustus, the August One, who sat in Rome, proud of his glorious kingdom. He decided to issue a decree for all the world to be taxed, requiring that everyone would have to return to their own hometown at the very call of the mighty king. He was motivated by his own ego, his own pride. He wanted to demonstrate his authority, and he wanted to express the extent of his empire. And yet, in reality, he was nothing more than a pawn in the hand of God. He thought he was showing the extent of his empire, but in reality, God was manipulating him, for God had a problem. There was a 9-month pregnant woman in a city called Nazareth and an overprecautious husband. And he needed to get them 100 miles south to Bethlehem in order to fulfill the prophecy that said Messiah would be born in the city of Bethlehem. And yet, how was God to persuade Joseph to move and to take up and to go down to Bethlehem in the 9th month of her pregnancy? Only one way, and that is if he was commanded by the king himself. And so God, working through the man's ego, maneuvering his pride, used Caesar as a pawn to get Joseph and Mary down so that Jesus could be born in Bethlehem in fulfillment of the ancient prophecy. Joseph needed the nudge from Caesar, but never forget that Caesar was being nudged by God. God is behind the scenes, manipulating things according to His purpose. Whenever you feel like, "Oh no, the world is out of control," that's not true. God is in control. God is at the helm. He has not fallen asleep. He is in charge. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the hearts. Verse 2 has been summed up. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, or man rationalizes, but the Lord weighs the hearts. God scrutinizes. Man rationalizes, but God scrutinizes. In Jeremiah chapter 17, we're told, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" Let me suggest to you that the last person you should trust is yourself. We are so prone to self-deception. Turn our backs just a little bit on the light of Jesus Christ, and we can think that we're doing fine. We can totally deceive ourselves, and we're the last ones to know it. Man rationalizes, God scrutinizes. Thank God that His Spirit convicts us and prods us and gets us back in line, you know, when we begin to stray. You know, many people consider themselves Christians, and yet in reality, they're not Christians at all. See, every way of a man is right in his own eyes. There are a lot of people that say, oh yeah, I'm a Christian. Their way is right. They think they're doing good. They think they're stacking up to God's requirements. You know, sure, I'm a Christian. You know, the person who thinks he's a Christian and yet is not is like the counterfeit dollar bill. That counterfeit dollar goes to, you happen to get one through normal exchange, and you thinking that it's genuine, go and you buy gas and you pay for your gas with that counterfeit dollar bill. Then the owner of that company turns around and pays his employees with that counterfeit dollar bill. Then his employees turn around and go buy groceries with that counterfeit dollar bill. Then the guy at the grocery store takes it to the bank, and suddenly the teller says to him, wait a minute, this is a bogus dollar bill. It's counterfeit. You know, I can't accept it. I can't receive it. In the end, it turns out bogus. While it was in circulation, it did a lot of good. But in the end, it proved to be false. There are a lot of people that are running around doing a lot of good. They're good people, moral people, concerned people, who are out doing this, doing that, all the while thinking that they're right with God, thinking that they're a Christian. While they're in circulation, everything's fine. But in the end, what will God say? Will He look into the heart? What will He find? You see, God scrutinizes. God knows what's in the heart. It doesn't really matter what you think about yourself. What matters is what does God say about you. The Lord weighs the hearts. To do righteousness and justice is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. Remember what Samuel said to Saul, to obey is better than sacrifice. A haughty look, a proud heart, and the plowing of the wicked are sin. It's interesting that the wicked man's wickedness goes far beyond just the haughty look or the proud heart. For in reality, everything he does, even the good things he does, even the noble deeds that he performs, even his honest work for a day's pay is wicked in the sight of the Lord. He says, even the plowing of the wicked is sin. For a man whose heart is wicked, everything he does is considered by God to be wicked. Everything is colored with his wickedness. The poison of his heart infects every action of his hands. It's been said that God sees all our actions through our heart. He sees all our actions through our heart. It's really the attitude of our heart that God looks at. And if our attitude is wrong, it doesn't matter what we do. You know, God is displeased. If our attitude is right, we can slip up and mess up, and yet God still considers us righteous. It's interesting what Titus chapter 1, verse 15 says, to the pure, all things are pure. But to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But even their mind and their conscience are defiled. Until our heart is right, nothing we do is right with God. He says, the plans of the diligent lead surely to plenty. But those of everyone who is hasty, surely to poverty. Here is a warning to the impulsive. Are there any impulsive people here tonight? You know, so many of us, our motto is this, and we don't realize it, but it's this. Ready, fire, aim. Rather than ready, aim, fire. So many of us act impulsively without thinking through our decisions, without praying through our decisions. Pray before you act. And it will save you a lot of problems. Pray before you buy. It will save you a lot of problems. Getting treasures by a lying tongue is the fleeting fantasy of those who seek death. The violence of the wicked will destroy them because they refuse to do justice. The way of a guilty man is perverse, but as for the pure, his work is right. It is better to dwell in a corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman. You heard about the man who says, "My wife is like an angel. She's always up in the air harping on something." You heard about the man who gone out for a drive with his wife, and his wife climbed into the back seat of the car and, you know, just for a nice leisurely ride into the country. And she proceeded all afternoon to tell him which direction to turn. I mean, every time he got ready to make a move, she was coaching him and telling him how to drive from the back seat. Finally, he pulled over the railroad tracks. And just as he pulled over the railroad tracks, he got the front of the car over, and the car stalled out, leaving the back two tires on the tracks. A train was roaring down the tracks. She looked down the tracks and saw the train coming right at her. She started screaming, "Move on, move on!" He turned and he said to her, "You've been driving from the back seat all day. Now I've got my end across the track. Let's see what you can do with your end." Ladies, I want you to please listen to me. There is nothing. I want you to listen. If you don't hear anything else I say tonight, you listen to this. There is nothing. Now, I thought I got this across the last time we ran across one of these verses, but some of you didn't hear. There is nothing that your husband hates. Nothing. That your husband hates more than your nagging. Nothing. Burn his meals. Run up charges on his credit cards. Invite your mom to come and live with you. Do anything you want, but just stop nagging the guy, and he'll be happy. He said he would rather stay on the housetop, over in the corner, out in the sweltering heat. He'd rather live on the roof with sunstroke than to live inside a house with a contentious or with a nagging woman. Had a sister who approached me after the last time I talked about this, which was 2 weeks ago. And she came up to me after the Bible study and she says, "You know, Sandy, we wouldn't have to nag our husbands so much if our husbands did what they were supposed to be doing." I thought we'd get a little reaction. And you know, she's probably right. If more husbands were self-starters, their wives wouldn't be cranks. Fellows, treat your wife like a thoroughbred, and she won't end up a nag. You're probably right. If your husband did do what he was supposed to do, you wouldn't nag as much as you do. But you see, that's not the point. Is whether your husband deserves it or not, you shouldn't nag. For your own benefit, you shouldn't nag. I know, wives, if your husband is like my wife's husband, you have plenty of reason to nag. But what I want to say is that nagging is counterproductive to what you want to accomplish in your husband. You see, when you begin to nag your husband, suddenly the nagging becomes an issue all its own. And he can now get the attention off what he's supposed to be doing, and he can put it on the nagging. You've just breeded his laziness. You've given him an excuse to never do what you want him to do. Badgering always backfires. It's not the way to motivate your husband. It breeds resentment. It builds up that resentment in your husband until suddenly it kills rather than cultivates the little bit of initiative he's got left. You need to find another way of motivating the man. rather than nagging, badgering him. The soul of the wicked desires evil. His neighbor finds no favor in his eyes. You see, an evil man refuses to try to get along with his neighbors. When the scoffer is punished, the simple is made wise. And when the wise is instructed, he receives knowledge. Notice, when the scoffer is punished, the simple is made wise. Stiff sentences and capital punishment is a deterrent to crime. When evildoers, when criminals are punished quickly and severely, the naive or the foolish look up and wise up. But when we give society the impression that crime pays, crime will run rampant. The righteous God wisely considers the house of the wicked, overthrowing the wicked for their wickedness. Whoever shuts his ears to the cry of the poor will also cry himself and not be heard. You know, what goes around comes around. And if you shut your doors to the poor, there may come a day when you're out on the street in need of some help. A gift in secret pacifies anger, and a bribe behind the back, strong wrath. It is a joy for the just to do justice, but destruction will come to the workers of iniquity. A man who wanders from the way of understanding will rest in the congregation of the dead. He who loves pleasure will be a poor man. He who loves wine and oil will not be rich. Did you see that? He who loves pleasure will be a poor man. Have you seen the new Reebok commercial? Life is short. Play hard. That's another version of eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Listen, life is more than just good times. I have found that happiness can never be found through direct pursuit. If you are seeking to be happy, that is the sure way to never find it. Happiness is always a byproduct of a right relationship with God. You see, where do we find pleasure? We find it in the presence of the Lord. I love Psalm 16. You will show me the path of life, and your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. I wish I could change the commercial. Life is short. Serve God. It's not pleasure, but it's the praise of God that truly matters. That'll be seen one day. The wicked shall be a ransom for the righteous, and the unfaithful for the upright. It is better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and angry woman. Listen, I don't write it. I just preach it. I'm not the author of this. I heard of the man who didn't know what true happiness was until he got married. And then it was too late. So it is for the man who lives with an angry and a contentious woman. In the Memphis Cookbook, there appears this recipe. Ladies, listen very closely. A good many husbands are utterly spoiled by mismanagement in cooking, and so are not tender and good. Some women keep them constantly in hot water. Others let them freeze by their carelessness and indifference. Some keep them in a stew with irritating ways and words. Some wives keep them pickled, while others waste them shamefully. It cannot be supposed that any husband will be tender and good when so managed, but they are really delicious when prepared properly. There is desirable treasure and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man squanders it. Make sure that you take advantage of the gifts and talents and abilities that God has blessed you with. He has given each of us resources. We should use wisely. Whoever guards his mouth and tongue keeps his soul from troubles. A proud and haughty man, scoffer is his name. He acts with arrogant pride. The desire of the slothful kills him, for his hands refuse to labor. He covets greedily all day long, but the righteous gives and does not spare. Now here he's saying that the righteous is doing the poor man a disservice. For his benevolence is actually breeding the poor man's laziness. For as the rich man gives to the poor and fulfills his greed, you know, he's only breeding his laziness. He's only facilitating his desire not to work. When our handouts strip a person of their incentive to work, we need to stop with the handouts. I think this is the problem in the United States and with our welfare system. For some people, it's more advantageous to be on welfare than it is to get a job. We're breeding the very problem that we're trying to eliminate. Never forget what Paul wrote to the Thessalonians. If a man doesn't work, he doesn't eat. God teaches workfare, not welfare. The sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination. How much more when he brings it with wicked intent? A false witness shall perish, but the man who hears him will speak endlessly. Now, the problem with a lie is that it usually starts with a liar, but it's perpetuated by honest people who believe it to be true. That's what he's saying. A false witness shall perish. He'll get his punishment. But the man who hears him will speak endlessly. The poor fellow who doesn't realize that it's a lie will go ahead and begin to blab it and spread it all around the world. That's why we need to make sure that we have verification before we begin saying things that could harm or damage someone's reputation. A wicked man hardens his face, but as for the upright, he establishes his way. There is no wisdom or understanding or counsel against the Lord. Nothing against the Lord succeeds. Man, you pit your wits against the Lord and you're determined to, you are destined to fail. No counsel against the Lord has ever succeeded, nor ever will. The horse is prepared for the day of battle, but deliverance is of the Lord. You know, we need to prepare ourselves. We need to train ourselves. We need to work hard, but in the end, the victory always belongs to God. He's the one who does the work. He's the one who brings the victory. A good name is to be chosen rather than great riches. Loving favor rather than silver and gold. My daddy used to always set me down as a kid, and he would tell me one thing. He said, "Sandy, it takes a lifetime to build a good reputation, and it only takes one night to destroy one." Never forgotten that. It takes a lifetime to build a good reputation, a good name. It takes only one moment, one slip, one night to destroy it. You heard of Ted Williams, the famous outfielder for the Boston Red Sox. He was one of the greatest baseball players to ever live, particularly one of the greatest hitters who ever lived. In fact, all his career, he never had a season where he hit below 300, except for 1959. And that was the year that Ted Williams suffered from a pinched nerve in the back of his neck. And in that one season, he ended up batting 254. At the time, Ted Williams was the highest paid athlete in all of sports. And the Red Sox came to him at the end of the season, offering him a new contract for the following year, paying him the same salary as he had made the year before. Williams refused. He demanded that they cut his pay the maximum that they were allowed, the 28%, and essentially threw away $35,000. Why? Because he didn't feel like he deserved the raise. His integrity was more valuable to him than riches. His dignity was more important to him than dollars. His good name was chosen over great riches and His loving favor rather than silver and gold. The rich and the poor have this in common. The Lord is the maker of them all. A prudent man foresees evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. You know, haven't you seen people that you know, they can't see beyond the nose on their face? I mean, they have no perception whatsoever. They go into some of the dumbest deals. I mean, man, can't you see what's beyond your nose? Can't you see what you're getting into, the trouble that you're begging for by going down this route? The wise man looks ahead. He foresees the evil and he hides himself from it. By humility and the fear of the Lord are riches and honor and life. Now, if you've noticed carefully, verse 4 seems to contradict verse 2. On the one hand, we're told that a man's destiny, his riches, are controlled by the Lord. The Lord is the maker of both the rich and the poor. And yet, on the other hand, here in verse 4, it seems that a man's riches and honor depend on his humility and fear, on his attitude. So which is it? Is it dependent upon God or is it dependent upon man? Both are correct. For the Bible teaches both God's sovereignty and man's responsibility. Yes, God does the work. But yes, the work is up to you. The Bible reveals both. It reconciles neither. And we scratch our heads and we say, how can two what appear to be contradictory positions be true? And yet that's exactly what the Bible teaches. That God is sovereign, and yet man is responsible. Heard of the preacher who had sat down for a fish dinner. And there was an atheist sitting across the table from him. And the atheist knew that he was a preacher, heard that he was a preacher, and so he said to the fellow as he was eating his meal, he said, look, he says, I hear you believe the Bible. And the guy said, sure I do. I believe every word of it. He said, well, if you believe the Bible, aren't you going to concede that there's some things in the Bible that you can't explain? He says, well, of course. He says, I believe the Bible, but I can't explain it all. There are a lot of things in the Bible that I can't explain. And the atheist thought, oh, I've got him. He says, well, if you can't explain these things in the Bible, what do you do with them? And the old preacher looked down and he said, I do just the same as when eating this fish. When I come to the bones, I put them to the side of the plate and go on enjoying my dinner. I leave the bones for some fool to choke on. See, what do you do when you come to a bone in the Scripture? Something you can't explain. Do you throw it out? Why throw it out? To me, it's only proof of the inspiration of this text. Because if I could understand it all, it really wouldn't be inspired, would it? If I could understand it all, how could it be a reflection of God's wisdom? My brain is a little pea brain compared to the wisdom of God. If I could understand all there's to know about God, He wouldn't be much of a God, would He? You know, why choke on the bones? Why not just enjoy what you know is true? What's been revealed? And one day, God will answer all our questions. One day, God will make sense of it all. God will put it all together, and we'll be amazed at how simple it was all along. And yet, you know, we couldn't figure it out. Thorns and snares are in the way of the perverse. He who guards his soul will be far from them. Train up a child in the way he should go. Now, this word to train up is a very interesting Hebrew word. The root of the word means literally the roof of the mouth or the gums. And the word was interpreted differently depending on the context in which it was used. There were times in which the word was used to bring into submission. That was the meaning of the word. And this meaning came from the practice of putting a bit or a bridle into the mouth of a horse. They pressed the bit up against the roof of the horse's mouth, and through the bit and bridle, they could manage the wild horse. And yet, it was also used to mean or to illustrate the developing of a thirst. This meaning came from the practice of the Hebrew midwife. When the newborn baby was placed into her arms, one of the first things that she did was to take some grape extract and squirt it out and massage the gums of the child with the extract. This produced a sucking reflex and helped the child to nurse and to feed from the mother. And so the word came to mean one of two things, either the bringing into submission or the developing of a thirst. Both meanings illustrate what a parent's effect should be upon their child. One of our responsibilities is to bring our children into submission. Our children are not born good and compliant and tolerant. Our children are born little sinners. They're born wild. They have a sin nature. And it's the job of the parent to tame the little barbarians. Your child has been born wild. It's up to you to domesticate him, to train him, to insert the bit of discipline against the roof of his mouth. And with the bridle in your hands, begin to steer that child in the right direction, to make that child manageable under your leadership and under your authority. It takes a gentle but firm hand of a skilled trainer to break a horse. And likewise, it takes a gentle but firm hand of a skilled parent to bring a child into submission, breaking his rebellion without breaking his spirit. This is the job of a parent. But it's also our job to develop in our children a thirst. A thirst for the things of God. A desire for the things of God. It is our responsibility to as parents to live the kind of Christian life that will attract our children to Christ. We need to display before them a fun, exciting, joyous Christian life. We need to show our children that we believe in something that warrants our own self-sacrifice. That we're willing to lay down our lives to see something fulfilled. There's something greater than ourselves that we're living for. That's the kind of life that your children will be attracted to. Understand this. Your job as a parent goes far beyond you insisting on your children's obedience. It's your responsibility to create in them a desire to obey. You're to develop a thirst in them for God, for the things of God, to see life from God's perspective. He says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, this is one of the most misinterpreted and misunderstood verses in all of Scripture. Most people read this verse, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he won't depart from it. And they conclude that, well, if we'll get our kids to church every Sunday, make sure they get to all the vacation Bible schools that they can, enroll them in Christian school, make sure they get all the Bible stories, cram it down their throat, and then when they get older and they go through their rebellious years, they'll come back to what they were originally taught. Our mistake is in the word that we emphasize. We emphasize, train up a child in the way he should go. In the way he should go. We emphasize the way. But the Hebrew emphasizes the word he. It's not train up a child in the way he should go. It's train up a child in the way he should go. And when he's old, he won't depart from it. Matthew Henry interprets it, train up a child according to his capabilities. And when he is old, he won't depart from it. In other words, when your child was born, he was not born a blank slate. This is one of the things that has amazed me most about being a parent. There are things that my children do that, man, I didn't teach them. Those of you that teach my kids in Sunday school, I mean, I didn't teach them all that stuff. Believe me. They didn't get that from me. Maybe, no, they didn't get it from Kathy either. I mean, our kids aren't born a blank slate. They come pre-programmed. Man, they, you know, it has just blown my mind how much the genetics play a part. I used to think it was all environment until I became a parent. Now I realize there's a lot of the genetics that play a part. They come into the world already shaped, already molded, with a personality all their own. And what he's saying is that if we will take the child and adapt and tailor our training to the individual child's needs, then what we communicate to them, they will remember. And when they're old, they won't depart from it. You see, the cookie-cutter approach to parenting very seldom works. This is why you see it all the time. Kids that have grown up in the same environment, the same family, with the same parents, been disciplined and been trained with the same, you know, rules and same standards, they turn out totally different. One's in jail, one's a preacher. How did it happen? Same parents, same everything else. Well, you see, the same things that work on one child and one personality won't work on another. You've got to tailor your training to that individual child, to his disposition, to his demeanor, to his desires. For example, you don't try to make an athlete and turn him into an artist. You don't try to take an artist and turn him into an athlete. Make a study of your child. Find out what makes your child tick, each individual child. In my case, it may take a while. But take the time to study your child. Find out how you can touch the heartstrings of your child. How you can get through to each child. And then tailor your training accordingly. Tailor your discipline accordingly. Train up a child in the way he should go or she should go. And when she's old, you won't depart from it. The rich rules over the poor. And the borrower is servant to the lender. Now, if you want to make a solid financial move, there is nothing that you can do that will better enhance your financial portfolio than to get out of debt and to stay out of debt. Romans chapter 13 tells us, owe no man anything except to love one another. If you run with the jet set, you'll wind up with the debt set. America unquestionably has the highest standard of living in the world. Too bad we can't afford it. I like this quote. If you're not in style, chances are you're out of debt. That fits me to the T. Just go out and look at what I drive. If you're not in style, chances are you're not in debt. You see, our problem is that desire to keep up with the Joneses, to have that new car, to be in style, to look cool, you know, to have that new thing that's out. We don't want to be the last one on the block to get a microwave oven. Come on, no, you know, microwave ovens are ancient relics. Let's get one. Come on, we can't afford it, but big deal. Put it on the Visa, no big deal. You know, and it's that desire for pleasure, that refusal to sacrifice, that drives us deeper and deeper in debt. But listen to Solomon's wisdom. What happens? The borrower ends up a servant to the lender. It's amazing how debt can dominate a person's life. You know, the number one reason for divorce, it's not mother-in-laws, it's not sexual dysfunction, it's not problems with siblings, it's not all the things that you might think. It's money. And the pressures that come from getting too deeply into debt. how the borrower becomes servant to the lender. Man, you can't do anything when you're in debt. You can't risk. You can't take a change. You can't change your job. You can't risk it. You know, you can't take a day off. Can't own a home. You can't give as much as you'd like to the Lord. I know people who God has called them into full-time Christian service. He's called them to the mission field. And yet they can't obey God because they're too far in debt. And they're working their way out of it. They've become a slave to debt. Smartest thing you can do is to get out of debt and stay out of debt. He who sows iniquity will reap sorrow, and the rod of his anger will fail. He who has a bountiful eye will be blessed, for he gives of his bread to the poor. Cast out the scoffer, and contention will leave. Yes, strife and reproach will cease. Paul was speaking to the Corinthians, and he said, don't you know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? A little bit of yeast thrown into the dough will contaminate the whole thing. One grumbling, complaining attitude in the church will spoil the church. It breeds, it infects the church, that bitter, complaining spirit. I heard of a pastor who had been preaching at a church for several months. He'd just gone to the church, been preaching and preaching and preaching. And a friend of his called him on the phone one day and said, hey, how's it going? Any blessed additions? And he said, no, there's not been any blessed additions, but there have been a lot of blessed subtractions. Let me say to you, sometimes when people are just grumbling and complaining about baseless, groundless things, we tell them, hey, you know, the best thing you can do is just move on. We have to. I mean, that's not hard, that's not callous, but that's the best for them, that's the best for us. If your attitude is just so hardened against things, that you're complaining about everything and everything's become an issue to you and you just can't tolerate the inadequacies of your brothers and your sisters and you just become a perfectionist, man, chances are that the thing is past. It's time you just moved on. Because one bad apple can spoil the whole bunch. And you get one person in the church who's bickering and complaining. Now, there's probably some times when you're right in bickering and complaining. We need to hear it. But if you're just grumbling for no reason and just gotten into an attitude where just nothing satisfies you, now that's a bad attitude. That's something that you know, shouldn't be tolerated. And the best thing, you know, he says, cast out the scoffer. And then the contention will leave. He who loves purity of heart and has grace on his lips, the king will be his friend. The eyes of the Lord preserve knowledge, and he overthrows the words of the faithless. The slothful man says, there is a lion outside. I shall be slain in the streets. And so he stays home and sips lemonade all day. The lazy man imagines difficulties before he encounters them. He looks for reasons why the thing will fail, so he doesn't have to try. The mouth of an immoral woman is a deep pit. He who is abhorred of the Lord will fall there. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him. Don't be reluctant to spank your kids. God has ordained the rod for your child's bod. In our society, we need more spank and less spock. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of your child. You're disciplining him and you're spanking him will drive it far from him. Man, if you don't spank your child, you don't love your child. That's what the Scripture says. Heard of a mom who used to hang the board that she used to spank her child. And she hung it right under a little plaque. And on the plaque it read, I need thee every hour. The kids never knew whether it meant the Lord or the board. Probably it meant both. The Lord and the board is what you need as a parent. He who oppresses the poor to increase his riches, and he who gives to the rich will surely come to poverty. Incline your ear and hear the words of the wise, and apply your heart to my knowledge. I hope that's what you've been doing. Really applying your heart to Solomon's knowledge. For it is a pleasant thing if you keep them within you. Let them all be fixed upon your lips, so that your trust may be in the Lord. I have instructed you today, even you. Have I not written to you excellent things of counsels and knowledge, that I may make you know the certainty of the words of truth, that you may answer words of truth to those who send to you? Do not rob the poor because he is poor, nor oppress the afflicted at the gate, for the Lord will plead their cause and plunder the soul of those who plunder them. Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go, lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul. Just be careful you become like the people you hang out with. Do not be one of those who shakes hands in a pledge. One of those who is surety for debts. How many times now has he told us not to co-sign for a loan? Unless we're willing to pay it. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should he take away your bed from under you? Do not remove the ancient landmark which your fathers have set. Do you see a man who excels in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before unknown men. Now, when you sit down to eat with a ruler, consider carefully what is before you, and put a knife to your throat if you are a man given to appetite. Do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food. How easy it is for us to allow the wealth of others to breed discontent in our own hearts. Man, you were totally content with eating hamburgers until the O'Malley's invited you over for steak. I mean, you were doing fine living in your little humble abode until you were invited over from some friends who were living in this mansion. I mean, and how the wealth of others can breed discontent in our own hearts. Don't get carried away with the whims and tastes of others. We need to learn to be content with the lifestyle that God has ordained for us. You know, God is going to bless some of you with a higher lifestyle and a higher standard of living than He's going to bless me with. God knows best. God makes both the poor and the rich, the Scripture says. God has a lifestyle that He's ordained for you. And it's important for you to be content with that lifestyle. So God's ordained for you to eat hamburgers. I like hamburgers. In fact, you might be surprised, but when I have a choice between a steak and a hamburger, I usually go for the hamburger. I like hamburgers. I'm used to eating them. They taste good. And we need to be careful. You know how easy it is. You know, put your knife to your throat. When you see the king's delicacies, be careful what you latch onto. What is it? Paul says, godliness with contentment is great gain. The rich man is the man who's learned to be content with what he has. And it's amazing how we can let something that we didn't even know existed 2 days earlier now rob us of the joy that we've been experiencing. Didn't even know there was such a thing as a bubbling bathtub. A jacuzzi? What? You didn't even know it existed 2 days ago, but now you want it. You already picked it out. I mean, you're not satisfied without it. Isn't that sad? And I'll be content with where God's got you and the lifestyle that He's placed you in. And then if you learn to be content, you'll stay out of debt. Do not overwork to be rich. This is a different twist. So far he's been talking about the lazy man, the slothful man. Now he addresses the workaholic. Do not overwork to be rich because of your own understanding cease. Will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. If your security is in money, understand that you will never feel secure. Because riches have wings. Money has wings. It just here today, gone tomorrow. We were talking the other day, a fellow who was approaching retirement, and we were talking about his situation, and you know, he told me, he says, you know, Sandy, he said, here I have, I've worked and I've worked and I've worked and I've worked and I've worked all my life. And yeah, I've saved up a little nest egg here, but do you realize that now I'm fixing to retire in one illness, one extended hospital stay can wipe me clean? Man, if your security's in money, you'll never feel secure. You'll never have enough to feel secure. Doesn't matter how much you have, you could get wiped out in an instant. I can remember when you used to kiss your money goodbye. Now you don't even have a chance to blow in its ear. Don't overwork to be rich. Man, lighten up. You know, it's amazing, people that work and work and work, and yet never have time to spend the money that they're making. Never have time to enjoy it. Don't overwork to be rich. Lighten up a little bit. Trust God with your future and with your finances. Man, take a day off occasionally. Spend some time with your kids. Take your wife for a walk. Go out and buy a T-bone steak on the Lord. You know. Lord, I'm just buying this T-bone steak, trusting you, Lord, to make up for it. You know, just give yourself a break. You know, unless, what's the psalm say? Unless the Lord builds the house, they that labor, labor in vain. The Lord's one that's going to do it. And all your working's not going to accomplish it. It's up to the Lord. And you've got to do your part. You know that. But hey, the end result's the Lord. You prepare for the battle, but the Lord brings the deliverance. So, don't overwork to be rich. Do not eat the bread of a miser, nor desire his delicacies. For as he thinks in his heart, so is he. Eat and drink, he says to you, but his heart is not with him, with you. The morsel you have eaten, you will vomit up and waste your pleasant words. Notice there in verse 7, for as he thinks in his heart, so is he. We are what we think. It's important what you allow to control your thoughts. If you feed your mind with secular movies and music, you will end up with a secular mind. The old computer lingo goes for our minds. Garbage in, garbage out. But godly in, godly out. And if you have a godly outlook, well, then you will have a godly mind, a godly heart. You know, be careful what you feed your mind. For a man, as a man thinks, so is he. Do not speak in the hearing of a fool, for he will despise the wisdom of your words. Do not remove the ancient landmark, nor enter the fields of the fatherless. Now, the fields and the boundaries of the property were established by little mounds of stone. These were the ancient landmarks that marked off the land and divided it up among the families. And what you could do is, if your neighbor died and he turned his land over to his kids were unfamiliar with the boundaries. And so you could really take advantage of him. You could go out one night and you could kind of skirt the stones over a few feet, and you could, little by little, you know, take more of his land by moving the pins, you know, the survey pins. And he's saying, don't do that. Be fair. Be honest. Now, there's a spiritual application here. There are people that want to rob us of our spiritual heritage. And they do so by moving the landmarks. Think of the history that you learned growing up in public school. I learned very little about God's part in the establishment of our country. You know, what role did you know, when we studied the pilgrims, we got the secularized pilgrims, I guess. We didn't really study much about their faith in God, their love for God, their desire for religious freedom. You know, the humanists of today have totally reinterpreted history to eliminate God, to leave God out of the affairs of man. You know, if you look at what's gone on in Eastern Europe in the last few years, if you've just been looking at the media, for all you know, it's been Gorbachev. He's the one that did it. Gorbachev is just a minor player in the thing. What has really brought about the freedom was the spiritual hunger and revival that has taken place in the people. They're discontent with the emptiness of communism and atheism and their desire for meaning and purpose and their thirst for God. That's what brought the Berlin Wall down. And yet that's been left out. There are humanists in our country that are trying to move the landmarks. And if we let them, we will allow them to steal the spiritual heritage of our children. Listen to this. This is how it works. To our forefathers, our faith was experience. To our fathers, our faith was an inheritance. To us, our faith is a convenience. To our children, our faith is a nuisance. And you see how it happens. It's by people removing the landmarks, little by little. For their Redeemer is mighty, He will plead their cause against you. Apply your heart to instruction and your ears to words of knowledge. Do not withhold correction from a child, for if you beat him with a rod, he will not die. That's an unfortunate translation. That's the old King James translation, beat him. The word literally means strike. It'd be better translated spank. Don't beat your child. God is not justifying child abuse here. Don't spank him on his arms or his legs. God, it's apparent by looking at the human anatomy where you're supposed to spank your child. God gave him the extra padding in his rear. That's where you spank your child, not the hands or the lips or the head or whatever. I hate it when I see somebody hitting the kid in the head. And spank him on the rear end. That's what the rear end's for, among other things. You shall beat him with a rod and deliver his soul from hell. Isn't that interesting? My son, if your heart is wise, my heart will rejoice. Indeed, I myself, yes, my inmost being will rejoice when your lips speak right things. Do not let your heart envy sinners, but in the fear of the Lord continue all day long, for surely there is a hereafter, and your hope will not be cut off. Sometimes we can get so discouraged when we see the wicked prospering, when we see the righteous suffering. Lord, how come he gets the promotion? Man, he's running off on his wife. He steals work from other people. He takes credit for things he didn't do. How come he gets the promotion and I don't? Hey, I'm trying to live a righteous life. And there's so many apparent contradictions. You know, if God is good, why do the evil prosper? Why doesn't he reward the righteous? And in the world today, we see so many contradictions. Somebody moaned, why is right forever on the scaffold and wrong forever on the throne? But notice the key word here. He says, for surely there is a hereafter. There is going to be a time when it will become apparent to all that God does judge the wicked and he does reward the righteous. And if you've lived a righteous life, then you'll have no regrets. It'll all be worth it then. In the end, wrong will forever be on the scaffold and right forever on the throne. Hear, my son, and be wise, and guide your heart in the way. Do not mix with winebibbers or with gluttonous eaters of meat. For the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe a man with rags. Now, did you catch that? An addiction to Mogan David is in the same category as an addiction to strawberry shortcake. You realize that? As far as God is concerned, drunkenness and gluttony are kissing cousins. And some of us turn up our nose at the guy who's struggling with alcohol while, you know, we're scarfing up another slice of strawberry shortcake. You know, gluttony and drunkenness, as far as God is concerned, same category. Now, from here to the end of the chapter, he talks about the dangers of wine and women. I guess you could summarize the old chapter, the dangers of wealth, wine, and women. Listen to your father who begot you, and do not despise your mother when she is old. Buy the truth, and do not sell it. Also wisdom and instruction. And understand, how do you buy the truth? Not with money. You buy it with the fear of the Lord. That's how you buy it. The father of the righteous will greatly rejoice, and he who begets a wise child will delight in him. Let your father and your mother be glad, and let her who bore you rejoice. My son, give me your heart, and let your eyes observe my ways. For a harlot is a deep pit, and a seductress is a narrow well. Boy, it's so easy to fall into an adulterous relationship. So easy. Man, if you're flirting with danger, you need to take heed. What does the Scripture say when we studied back earlier? No man takes fire to his bosom and doesn't get burned. Man, if you're flirting with a girl, if you have designs or ambitions on a girl, if you're toying with the idea of slipping off on your husband, listen, you need to repent quick. Get your heart and life right with God. It's so easy to let yourself slip into an adulterous affair. It's like a deep well. It's so easy just to stumble into it. But it's much, much harder to get out. Make sure that you don't take that fatal step and fall. Not something to play with. She also lies in wait as for a victim and increases the unfaithful among men. Now, who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Besides the man who's been living in with that woman that we've been reading about. Who has complaints? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of the eyes? Those who linger long at the wine. Those who go in search of mixed drink, mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it is red or when it's fermented. When it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. Isn't it amazing how the very appearance of alcohol is so deceptive? Just look at the beer commercials. They zoom in on the mug. And there the beer just pours out into the mug. It just cascades. The bubble, you can see the bubbles in it, you know. It just cascades and just bounces off the sides of the glass and swirls and dances and sparkles as it fills the cup. And then the foam just oozes over the lips of the glass and rolls down the sides of the cup so innocently and so nice. And you say, oh man, that looks so refreshing. I saw a commercial recently where all they did was just turn the screen into a big mug. You've seen that commercial. And they just poured the beer into your television. Like they poured into your television. And your whole television was just the beer. It's appealing. I mean, beer just looks good. I mean, it dances and it sparkles and all. It just looks so good. Man, that's so appealing. Man, to look at a six-pack and a couched in a chest of ice, you know, and two girls carrying it on their shoulders, you know, across the beach. And you just look at that six-pack couched in that ice in that cooler and you say, wow, that just looks so refreshing. He says, don't look on the wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. Man, you need to jerk your head away from that TV. He says, for at last it bites like a serpent. And it stings like a viper.
It's amazing how something so inviting can become so infecting. It can become such a poison in our veins. Your eyes will see strange things. And your heart will utter perverse things. Sad what you'll say when you're drunk. Yes, you will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea. Like somebody tries to lie down on a bed of water. Or like one who lies at the top of the mast. It'd be pretty hard to lie on top of a flagpole. And yet his point is that if you allow yourself to get drunk, if you tarry long when the wine is red, you're going to be placing yourself in dangerous situations. Situations that you can't control. Precarious situations. You're making yourself vulnerable every time you tip the glass and put it to your lips. You're flirting with danger. He says, they have struck me. And here's the stupefying, dumbing effects of alcohol, the numbing effects. They have struck me, but I was not hurt. They have beaten me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake that I may seek another drink? You see, that's the thing about alcohol. It's a narcotic. It's a numbing thing. It numbs you. You're not aware of what you're doing to yourself, let alone how you're destroying your family. You don't realize how it's affecting your job and how your performance is deteriorating and deteriorating and deteriorating. You know, it's destroying you and you're the last one to know it. All you can think about, man, when can I get another drink? Be careful. Be careful. Be careful of wealth. Be careful of the strange woman or the strange man. There are a lot of those out there too. And be careful of the wine when it is red.